Well, it's great to be here back for session number two. And before I get into the specific topic for session number two, I'd like to do two things related to yesterday. One is, I'd be interested if there were anyone who was so inclined as to tell me what they wrote as their definition for my question of what is a Christian. Just a few people. Okay. I see a hand, yes.
One bought with Christ's blood to be conformed to God's image.
Okay, good, okay.
A Christian is someone who loves, follows, and shares Christ.
Okay, good. Okay. Anyone on? We're getting a lot here. Are there any brave souls to my right? Yes.
A disciple of Christ, an ambassador of the kingdom of God.
Okay. One more from this side.
Something about becoming fully human.
I like that. I like that one. Okay. All right. I just wanted to hear something because if I asked you to write it out, well, I was just, you know, I'm curious. Well, I asked you, I told you what I think, but it'd be nice to know what you said. So, thank you for giving me a few of those. All right. And then before diving in, does anyone have like a burning question from yesterday that you left and it's like, well, I was about to ask, but then we called it a night, and you'd like me to address that question before I dive into this?
Well, it starts out with the question. Maybe it's a rhetorical question.
Yes.
Don't we, as humans, tend to complicate anything that God has set out?
Okay. Do we as humans complicate everything or anything that God basically asks us to do, right? Yes, we do. But the fact of complication isn't reason for us to opt out. It's just part of the territory. Only if you believe that we should be having and expecting what you call a realized eschatology, which means experiencing now the complete fullness of God's kingdom, only if that should somehow be the Christian experience, should we expect things to not have some kind of complications. So, if realized eschatology is sort of the way you think about things, then yes, you should be frustrated. If not, you shouldn't be surprised, I think, right? Although it has occurred to me that a lot of times when people complain about things, when they're cynical about things, I think what they're really saying is I want to realize eschatology and I want it right now. And because I'm not having it right now, I'm going to make a big stink about it. Because things just aren't the way I think they should be. But then I'm tempted to ask, well, do you really expect the fullness of the kingdom to be happening right now? Is that really what you believe? And I don't think necessarily that's what people believe, but I think it's what they long for, and their frustration or cynicism or anger is a reflection of their longing for things to be resolved, and their being upset with the fact that they are having some magnified experience of exactly how it's not resolved. So in part, I understand why people may get cynical, whiny, etc. But sometimes it's the way that they express their desire for realized eschatology that is sometimes difficult to deal with. Let's put it that way. Okay, other questions before I give you another question to answer in 10 words or less? Everyone's getting ready to write. Okay. So, the question is, what is our mission as Christians? What is our mission as Christians? 10 words or less in 30 seconds. Time's up. Who would like to volunteer that hasn't spoken already of what they wrote? Even if it's in a complete sentence, you can say, and then there's an ellipsis after that, or a blank. So,
To reach the unsaved and through the Word in our lives.
Okay. Good.
I have to share Jesus and how He has impacted our lives.
Okay, good.
To know Christ and to make Him known.
Okay. That sounds like a good navigator's one. That's back in my navigator days. That was their motto, to know Christ and make Him known. Does navigators mean anything to anybody around here, right? The parachurch organization, right? Yeah. Yes, massively influential in all my life, yes.
To love God and to love and serve our neighbors.
Okay, good. Anyone else? One more? To fulfill the Great Commission. Okay, all right. Great. Okay. It's like here's, I'm going to cheat. Right. Good. I appreciate it. All right. So what does he say, right? And why did I ask? Because just as how you define Christian, it's sort of like leading the witness in terms of answering, you know, other questions about what you think our opportunities, priorities, responsibilities are. If you talk about mission, it's the same thing. I mean, if you talk about what mission is, it's an indicator of where your energy is going, of what your priorities are, what your actions are going to be. So, my answer, a holistic witness to God's kingdom. So that's, there are ways that you answered it that I could have said as well, but particularly in terms of what we're thinking about, I think a holistic witness to God's kingdom is the way that I want to talk about that. So this includes connecting people with the church, by which I mean people, you know, becoming Christians, growing as Christians, being formed as Christians in the life of the church. So people could be made into disciples, the disciple making, spiritual formation, a task of the church. And it also means an active social and cultural witness as part of what Christians are and do. And it's that last part, an active social and cultural witness, that's the reason for the title that may seem like a strange title. What do you mean, no special interest? Well, what I mean is that at least in my experience, and I think there has been some some change in this, but I'll make a comment about that change in a second. But in my experience, in the conversations that people have about Christian witness, there are dimensions of social, cultural, political engagement that seem to be these sort of special categories that, like, if it's your thing, then hey, it's great. I'm glad that's your burden. It's not my burden. So great, good for you. And perhaps I should care about it. Perhaps it should be on my radar, but it really has nothing to do with me. I kind of want to challenge that. Now, when I noted as a sort of side comment something about the contemporary era, I will note this. If you look at generally big picture conservative Christians in the last 40 years, prior to the last 40 years, you have really, I think, the most Christians operating out of what happened after the end of the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the late 1920s. Well, it went throughout the 1920s, but it was a culmination that happened in 1929. So eventually what happened was, when I talk about the fundamentalist modernist controversy, that you had only what we now call mainline denominations. United Methodist Church, your Presbyterian Church, USA, etc. Within those denominations, you had people who were having disputes about the authority of the Bible. You know, in other words, did you think the Bible was completely true or mostly true? And out of that, what were you going to be teaching and preaching about who Jesus was? Was he born of a virgin? Was he resurrected? If he was crucified, was he did he get up, or was that just a way of talking about how his memory lives on? Are the miracles real stories, or is that just the way that people talked in the ancient world? These kinds of things. So hence, the modernists, to varying degrees, changed the way that people had talked about the story. So they would still read those texts, but then they would say, what those texts really mean, wasn't that a lot of these things actually happened, but it's the way that ancient people talk, because, okay, this is kind of my code language for the way the modernist Enlightenment mind was, because we've graduated from the need for those things. We don't need miracles. We don't need to talk about demons. But why? Because we're good, rational, scientific people who can explain everything. That's why. And because we're liberated from those traditions. Translation, if you're a modernist, you get to kill the parents that came before you. But a lot of the people that had modernist ideas, they were in tension with people that were called fundamentalists. Now, usually when we think about fundamentalists as a term now, we think about it meaning anti-intellectual people that are militant, hostile, and particularly in terms of our own current parlance, it's expanded to mean people that, because they're militant about their beliefs, they're likely to use violence. That's not what it meant. Okay, that's been an expansion of the term fundamentalist beyond what it meant then. It's an expansion that happened in the last 20 years because of modern terrorism, etc., and ways of talking about particularly certain kinds of commitments that include violence with Muslims and other extremists. But what it meant was people who held to certain fundamentals of the faith. Fundamentals about the truthfulness of the Bible, about the truthfulness about certain facts about Jesus. He was born of a virgin. He actually existed. He actually died on a cross. He was actually resurrected. His death on the cross was actually a sacrifice that is an atoning sacrifice for us. Now, it also included, for some people, premillennial eschatology. I'm just noting that, but there are a lot of people who call themselves fundamentalists that were not premillennialists, like, say, J. Gresham Machen, for example. So the point is that in the fundamentalists lose in those denominations, or if they don't lose, they just make their own world. A lot of the fundamentalists, in making their own world, they withdraw from the culture in a way. Now, that doesn't mean they don't vote, but they don't think people should be involved in politics. You shouldn't think about having, if you think about trying to have that in terms of the way society was going, the people were fighting for the rudder in terms of the direction of society, they basically said, just forget the rudder. So that's kind of what a lot of people say. So if you go from, say, the late 1920s to around 1970, basically, conservative Christians of various denominational stripes who were in that initial term of fundamentalism, in other words, which basically just meant people who believe traditional Christianity. That's all it meant. It didn't become anti-intellectual, etc., until after the 1930s with the way certain people gave further definition to fundamentalism that meant anti-intellectual, etc. But whether or not they were the people who went on to be anti-intellectual or the people that became called evangelical or people who took on, made being certain kind of Presbyterians more prominent in their identity, whatever it was, what generally was the case was minimal engagement in society. Even if people might still vote, participate in the military, things like that. So after the 70s, when you begin getting a kind of reentry. But even with that reentry, it's probably, in my view, until the late 90s, where all of a sudden most conservative Christians start saying things like, well, of course we should be involved in politics, of course we should be involved in Hollywood, etc., etc., etc. And part of that is, I think, part of the enthusiasm that attends the election of George Bush the Younger in 2000. Very quickly, once the Iraq War started, the excitement people had about this kind of engagement became massively complicated because you had a war, which nobody was anticipating, and a war that didn't just end when the president announced victory on, I can't remember the name of the ship, but, went several years after that. So people became kind of, they developed a distaste. And the reason I'm saying all this is that there's been a complicated relationship with thinking about how much we should actually care about things like politics, cultural engagement, etc. Because in other words, there was like enthusiasm, we should do it. And it's like, oh wait, this is really complicated. And even if people have felt like, well, this is what we should be doing, that complication that you talked about, and lots of unanticipated complications, make people say, well, I think maybe we should do it, but I'm not so sure. Right, so, and I think that's kind of where we are right now. So, and I guess one other thing. And I think for a lot of people that think that we should be involved culturally, it's really at the level of a theological or biblical intuition that we should be involved holistically in society. They can't necessarily articulate, I think, with great depth why. But we should. And even though I think we should, they think, but I'm not so sure how much is worth it. Because it's just messy. So, I think, yes, it's messy, but that's not an excuse to opt out. And I particularly want to make the case that social engagement is a vital part of witness. Now, one thing that I didn't say that was a part of the reason for people not engaging society is because they had a reaction to something that was called the social gospel. Okay, can I just see a show of hands? If I say the word social gospel, you have some idea of what I'm talking about. Okay, so I've got about like 75%. Awesome. So, Walter Rauschenbusch is a great example. Okay. So what happens with the social gospel? You basically say, pretty much everything that we're doing as Christian is about what we are doing here and now. So you translate the language about salvation into, for example, addressing, you know, things that happened in the wake of industrialization. You know, because that's a big problem in the early part of the 20th century. Well, we say it's still a problem. But so you talk about salvation in terms of what you're doing to make people's lives better, to the exclusion of talking about people's personal reconciliation with God. And because that happened, or I would say to the mostly exclusion of people's personal relationship with God, because I don't think that Rauschenbusch never thought about that, but he mostly talked about other things, or he mostly became known for talking about the other things, and other people who were social gospelers were associated with that. So the thing you have to recognize about that language of social gospel, into the 1990s, was like a bad word. I'll just give you one illustration. When I was in my one of the class that I took on missions while I was in seminary, we had a guest from one of the other missions professors who came in, and we were talking about the question of, is social action part of the gospel? Well, our mission professor was very nervous about including that. And because I wasn't, you know, aware of like the history part, I mean, and because to me it just made perfect sense to me that it should be some, at least an expression of what we're doing with the gospel, I was you know, curious about all of this. But there were a lot of people who, even though you had this Lausanne statement in the 1970s that made social action part of Christian witness, there are a lot of people who are like, oh, I just don't know that we can do that. Why? Because it might be social gospel. That's why. That's why. And if it's social gospel, what happens? All you do is reduce what we do to saving society and not souls, basically. So, yes, that's a problem. But I don't think you solve the problem by having its opposite problem, which is that you emphasize introducing people to Jesus and talking about having typically spiritual concerns, and then you don't really give much priority to great social challenges. It's what other people do. And then you say, because you heard about some other group that went and did missions in another part of the world, and all they did was build hospitals, and they never talked to anybody actually about meeting Jesus, that of course then, if you talk about building hospitals, by definition, you just won't even think about talking to people about Jesus, because that's what somebody else did. All right. Well, I think that's not a good reason to not build hospitals, for example. But that problem was there. And I think, to a certain degree, it's not completely gone. And it probably depends on what circles you're in, how much it's gone or not. So what I think we have to do to recognize that social engagement is part of witness is we have to develop resistance to this allergy to the social gospel that some people may still have, or to whatever lingering of, you know, remainder there is of that allergy. And we have to recognize that even though people have started to think at a level of intuition that we ought to have a holistic ministry or holistic witness, that we need something more robust. And I'll just use one example that to me was quite obvious while I was in seminary, and actually I think it remains this way. And that is, if people are actually willing to talk about all of the reverberations of race in society. Here's one way to think about it. Just think about it this way. I would love to take a survey of various churches and various denominations, and I'm not a sociologist, you know, so I don't know how to put together survey tools, right? But if I had like the right person who does this, you know, I would ask them, is there a way that you can ask people what they really think when they hear the word urban? Now, what does urban mean? Or if you talk about urban ministry or urban concerns, what does that translate to for them? And I wonder how long it takes them to get from urban to non-white. Right? And from urban to perhaps middle class, but mostly below middle class. Right? Never mind all the hipster gentrification that's going on in cities right now. Okay? Because that's definitely urban. Okay? City center stuff, you know, skyrocketing. You know, prices. So, but if you say urban, what does that mean? It's even like, okay, what's urban contemporary radio? Right? Well, you know, it's not just music from the city. Okay, well, what does city mean? So I think it's an important thing to think about, because my sort of slight specialization when I was getting my master's degree was in urban ministry, and I know that certainly when I was initially thinking about urban ministry, it was because, I mean, urban was code for city and African Americans. I mean, that's what it was, right? But here's the thing. Because it was a specialization, the point is that it was a specialization. It's something that some people will give an emphasis to, and others might have, it might be somewhat on your radar. It's nice to know about. You're glad that somebody is giving some attention to it. But it's not necessarily something that most people should give attention to. I think that's a mistake. What occurred to me, and still occurs to me, is that if you're going to get people to take racial and ethnic concerns seriously, and actually, where we are now, this is not just about African Americans. It's about all the conversations that are connected to what people think when they think immigration. Because when most people are thinking about immigration, they're not thinking about Eastern Europeans that come over illegally or Asians that come over illegally. Right? They're thinking people coming up from the South. I mean, that's all. I mean, if you say immigration, close your eyes, immigration. What do you see? Okay, you know, perhaps you see somebody using a scare attack ad, you know, in Texas saying, if you elect that person, here's what's happening. And they show, like, at night, you know, people crossing the border and stuff. I've seen at least one political ad that way. I thought, are you serious? If you elect this person, these people are going to come, like, take over your neighborhood or something? I mean, it's ridiculous. Especially since that ad I saw in Illinois. So, I was like, come on. But the point is that immigration means, oh, those brown people. Right? Even though it's not just brown people. So, the point is that we have to attend to those kinds of concerns as not just a special interest, because we inhabit a world where the fact that we even think about color as associated with things like prejudice, or even associated with a word that is really a perversion of the word, I think, with the word race, because we inhabit that world, we inhabit a world with a bunch of complications because that's our reality. And if we don't look at that reality, and if we don't see how attending that reality is part of mission, or not just mission for people for whom it's a special interest, then I think we wind up being unintentionally complicit in just kind of saying, well, you know, it's really off my radar. I'm sorry that it happens, but it happens. Well, that's a problem if that's what we think. So, of course, how do we think about this as part of mission? Well, there's two things I think we have to do. The first is we make sure we know exactly what we're talking about, and then how that thing that we're talking about is connected to mission. So, that's what I'm going to do. Briefly, because it's 9:15, because I want us to talk. Okay, doesn't mean I'll probably take more than 15 minutes to wrap this up. So that's just a warning. So here's the thing. Think about it like this. This modern world, which is now a post-Enlightenment world, but still modern in some ways. So whether you want to say postmodern or modern or post-postmodern or whatever. I mean, there's just libraries full of people using that word. Okay, so I'm sorry. It's like trying to, you know, neatly articulate something, and then people articulate it 20 different ways. But let's just go with modern. Okay, all right, which basically means anything since Descartes, since the 16th century. Okay, 17th century. Following that time, a great thing happened. People began to recognize that they could sort of become masters of nature, and they could understand nature and categorize things. You have the rise of modern science coming along with this, humans being enamored of the fact that they're rational thinking beings, self-ruling beings, they think. And people are very excited and pay a lot of attention to nature. And in categorizing nature, they categorize all kinds of things. Well, they also categorize people. And when they start categorizing people, somehow you get the creation of these things called races. And it's interesting to note how the categorization gets connected to, you know, just scientific observation. The point being that if you create the idea that you're categorizing people scientifically, then what are you doing? All you're doing is just describing what's there. Just what's the real. I'm just describing this group of people, and this group of people, and this group of people, and this group of people. And just like we categorize plants, or animals, or whatever, when we categorize people, you know, we talk about characteristics of people. But an interesting thing happened along the way when they started categorizing people with their characteristics. They didn't just talk about things like complexion, body shape, hair type, whatever. They started talking about things like, that we might call cultural characteristics. Like whether or not people are governed by, you know, laws or governed by caprice, let's say. No, if you're a person governed by caprice or capricious, I mean, you know, you don't know what to expect. And it was interesting who wound up on top in the categorization. Europeans did. The people who were doing the categorization. And the people that wound up on bottom were the people that were the darkest. And, you know, and it just was what it was. And basically what you have emerging is this idea that if you have a minimal amount of melanin, that's the pigment that makes things darker, then you're higher on the scale. And if you have more melanin, you're lower on the scale. Really lower on the scale of being human. So people talk about today, for example, they use the term white supremacy. It's really not about just whether people wear hoods or swastika or wear swastikas. No, it's really about the construction of a world where people just take for granted that if you're on one part of the scale, of course you're like sort of what normative humanity is. And if you're on the other part of the scale, there's something deficient about you. And whether or not people actually articulate that, it just kind of winds up being kind of part of what you breathe in the air. And to varying degrees, you know, since the 17th century, I mean, we've lived in the wake of people categorizing humans this way and using the word race to categorize them and in different ways talking, sort of describing what they meant by that. But it's wound up creating a great problem for us because it's created this idea of a hierarchy of human beings. And that hierarchy of human beings facilitates things like slave trades, or facilitates ways of thinking about the way you structure a society is you need to have certain people running the society, and you would never imagine certain other people ever running a society because you don't think that those people are capable of running society. I mean, one microcosm of it is the whole thing that still exists, really, about whether you can really have a black quarterback run it, you know, in an NFL team. And that if you do have one, can you ever describe that quarterback the way that people, for example, describe Peyton Manning? How do people describe Peyton Manning? Wow, what a brain that guy has. And believe me, the guy's got a brain. I mean, he's like massively perfectionistic, etc. But how do people describe Cam Newton, Robert Griffin, how do they describe James Harris, etc., etc.? The tendency is, wow, they're really athletic. That tends to be the case. Right? Now, of course, anyone's on the field's athletic. You're like this percentage of people that make it in the NFL. Okay, if you're not athletic, you're not going to get one of those coveted positions. All right. So my only point is that not that everybody that describes every African American quarterback only uses the term athletic, but it's as if an effort needs to be made to describe someone as something other than that. Well, why? I mean, why default certain ways and why default in other ways? What are the basis of those things? How much of that is based on just what you observe? How much of it is on the basis of assumptions that are so deeply embedded in the world that we have that you tend to talk about certain people groups in certain ways and you tend to talk about others in other ways? Right? And it's the same thing as assuming that if you talk about Asians, whatever that means, because you talk about an entire continent, but if you talk about Asians, of course Asians are going to work harder, be smarter, etc. Really? Which Asians are you talking about? Are you talking about people from Laos? Vietnam? You know, no, usually you're talking about Chinese, Japanese, or Koreans. That's who you're talking about. Now, last time I checked, those aren't the only countries in Asia. So, but the assumption is, oh, Asian, therefore, will work hard, we'll get, you know, etc. I mean, it's like you realize that, you know, people from Indonesia, people from Thailand, you know, just pick all these countries, these are not all the same people. But again, oh, Asian, they work hard. Well, okay, you think everybody from Asia works hard is what you're saying. Is that what you're saying? I mean, is that the point? Or that everybody from Asia just knows how to do math? Really? I mean, say, why don't you go to those countries in Asia and then do your evaluation and come back over here and tell me whether that works, right? So all that to say is that, I mean, we've got a big problem about how we categorize people. And see, and this is where I think we can actually move towards showing why, when we talk about issues of race and ethnicity, is actually connected to mission. How's that? Well, in this sense. What's happened in the modern world with race and all the reverberations of it, and all the, you know, the bad things that have happened in creating stratified societies, etc., that is not a new thing for people to categorize other people. It's just a modern innovation in how you categorize people. And a modern innovation that got connected with the way that you build quote-unquote civilization. And in building modern civilization, you structure it to serve certain people and for other people to do the serving, so to speak, in that. Now, of course, there's also things like class and stuff that's part of this. Okay, so it's not as simple as race, but race is a prominent part of it. It's a modern categorization scheme that gets connected to power and influence and structuring a society, etc. And the point is this. It's been a problem at least since Genesis 6, if not before, for people to categorize other people as some kind of other. And by virtue of categorizing them as some kind of other, what do you do with others? You either rule over that other or you destroy them. I mean, it's just the way things go. I mean, how peaceful do you really think it was during the era of, you know, when Israel was a nation? You know, we read about in the Old Testament. I mean, war happened all the time. And there are ways that people categorize themselves as a certain group of people, and then there were the other groups of people. Now, what did they think about those other groups of people? Did they think, you know, we really should just all live in a utopia together? No, I mean, there's reasons why they went to war all the time, right? Because somebody wanted to be in charge. I mean, it's always been that way. It's always been that way. So my point is this, is that when we talk about racism, ethnocentrism, you know, whatever kind of ism you want to talk about that's associated with how people are categorized, and then as a result of those categorizations, a society gets built that's had good and bad things about it, and certain bad things, particularly, that's an expression of what's happened really since Genesis 3, honestly, where you've had dissonance, you know, resonance, things work together, dissonance, things don't work together, where you've had dissonance between human beings. And in having that dissonance, well, people aren't getting on so well. And people keep coming up with better ways to negotiate the dissonance, often by somebody saying, I'm going to get the power, and when I get the power, everything's going to conform to the way I want the world to run. And if you're not like me, too bad. And maybe you can conform to me. If you can't conform to me, maybe if I don't kill you, I'll subjugate you. Right? I mean, that's not, you know, a new thing. It's a very, very, very old thing. It's a very, very old sin problem. So you've identified it as a kind of problem. What does that have to do with being part of mission? Okay. I will use one of the definitions I was given as an example as to why it's part of mission. What was your definition of mission again? Oh, no, wait. Who gave you the two greatest commandments as part of mission? Yes, you did. All right, go ahead. Yeah. Okay, and then who said loving God and neighbor? You said it. Okay, all right, yeah. So if loving God and neighbor is what our mission is, right? Okay. Now, think about the two greatest commandments this way. The first greatest commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Right? That's a positive articulation of the first command of the Ten Commandments. And the first command in the Ten Commandments is stated negatively, which is, you have no other gods before me. Now, if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, you can't have any other gods. There are no pretenders. So, that first grace commandment is the first commandment, rearticulated. But articulated in terms of the fact that we are giving all of our love, devotion, etc. to God. What that means, if you're really giving all of that to God, one thing you can't do is make your people, whoever your people are, God. You can't make an idol out of your kind of people. And your kind of people are an idol, whoever your kind of people are, if you run a world where your kind of people are normal or the norm and everybody else is abnormal and you subjugate everybody. Right? Again, it's just, you know, nothing more than people buying the temptation in the garden, you know, you will be like God. You know, or if you think about the Hollywood hype man type of thing, you're going to be great. That's basically what, you know, the serpent says. Just take a bite. You're going to be marvelous. Right? In other words, you get to be in charge. Didn't work out so well. But people have continued to try to make it a reality. So, if you obey the first greatest commandment, you can't do that. And then the second greatest commandment, if you love your neighbor as yourself, that seems to make oppression kind of difficult. Because, you know, the assumption with the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself, is that we're talking about people that are sane, right? So, and sane people aren't interested in harming themselves. They're interested in their good. They're interested in their flourishing. We take that for granted. People who are not interested in their flourishing, we say they have a problem. Right? We don't think about them, you know, thinking about their own good. We say, well, they have a problem with self-harm or something like that. The assumption of the second greatest commandment is that people are seeking their good. And you seek the good of others like you seek your own good. Now, if that's the case, if part of mission, which again, I'm calling it, you know, holiness, witness to God's kingdom, if that includes human beings obeying the first and second greatest commandments, in other words, that all the commands are some expression of ultimate fidelity to God and a disposition toward other human beings where you hope for them and perhaps work for them in a way that you seek their good just like you seek your own good, then if that's really what you're committed to, it's very hard to say that when other human beings are subject to the construction of a world which has created all kinds of problems, that you can just ignore those problems. Or that this is somebody else's problem. No, it's your problem. Why is it your problem? Because they're human beings. That's why. Because they're your neighbor. That's why. I mean, I think one of the most the powerful things about Jesus using the parable of the Good Samaritan about the neighbor is that now, there's no way any Jew is thinking, when they hear him telling that story, well, you know who's going to help him. Well, it's going to be the priest. Okay, or the Levite. Well, yeah, they were kind of busy. And so then along comes a Samaritan. A Samaritan. A half-breed. Are you serious? One of them. That's the neighbor? No! No, that's not how I would tell the story, Jesus. Don't tell the story that way, please. Give us an easy out, why don't you? Well, he doesn't. He doesn't. And the point is that we don't have an easy out either. And my point in saying this, then, is that it's not that everyone can do everything, because everybody can't. But there are a lot of people that aren't doing a whole lot. And a lot of people that use the fact that other people are paying attention to things as an excuse for them to not have to deal with it. Or the fact that there was a social gospel that made the gospel only about social action as an excuse to say, well, you know, I don't want to make the gospel only about caring about society. Well, that's not an excuse to not care about society. I mean, in fact, what it sometimes betrays is that, well, society is working out okay for me. So I don't really need to pay much attention to how society is not working out for other people. Unless there's somebody that I care about. Then all of a sudden it becomes important to me. But if your neighbor is essentially the whole human race, then, I mean, we just don't get off the hook. And if we don't get off the hook, then we have to start asking, how do we attend to these great problems? Let me use a sort of stark example to talk about how I've been encountering this lately. Whatever you think about what happened with Darren Wilson and Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Whatever you think about that, okay? And nobody knows because, you know, every week there's a story, you know, one week, you know, the cop story is better. Next week, but the witnesses, you know, said Brown had his hands up. You know, it's like, well, probably there's like, it's complicated. There may have been an altercation, then he backed up, then he got shot. I mean, we don't know, right? I mean, who knows? But here's the whole point. I know a lot of people that say over and over again, nobody or most people in the United States don't care about, this is their phrase, black bodies. And particularly black male bodies. They care about black male bodies being incarcerated because then allegedly society's safer. Why? Because black male bodies are dangerous. Well, where does that idea come from? Oh, wait. That sounds like something that was part of the construction of the modern world. Right? Well, they're dangerous. Well, what is that? What do you mean they're dangerous? You know? And even if Michael Brown, burglarized this store. Okay, let's assume he did. Okay, is that reason to say, well, yeah, he probably should have been shot anyway? Because there are a lot of people who, in code, basically say that. Well, you know, he kind of got what was coming to him. Really? Really? And it's interesting to me that, there was yet another school shooting yesterday, this time in Seattle. Not the typical MO of the school shooter, right? Because this kid had been like the freshman prince of the, you know, homecoming, etc. But it's very interesting that, it's predominantly most school shooters are what? White males. Right? And nobody seems to think that there's a problem with white males because school shootings happen by mostly white males. It's just kind of interesting. You know, they're exceptions. But when things like Trayvon Martin or Mike Brown happen, what is suggested very often by many people is that, well, you know, I mean, you know, they're just kind of that way in those neighborhoods. Really? Well, I wonder about the neighborhood where all these shooters come from. You know, nobody talks about those neighborhoods. And the question, why are all these white people that you know, somehow have, like, handguns and automatic weapons? I mean, nobody thinks this is a problem, or many people don't, or they think it's only an exception, but it's typical over here. What frame of mind enables this to be an exception and this to be typical? Right? A frame of mind that leads friends of mine to say, people care more about white bodies than black bodies. And because they do, you know, by default, if something goes wrong over here, it's got to be an exception. Because we're not like that. Over here, well, you know, they're just kind of rough. Well, I mean, there's so many unspoken things. And so many things we don't know about all of these things. I mean, we still don't know very much about Adam Lanza, the kid that went into the elementary school. Right? We know that that was a difficult circumstance. Right? There's all kinds of stuff we don't know about it. But nobody acts like, of course, most white kids are Adam Lanza. A lot of people kind of assume, well, you know, most of these Negroes are kind of like Mike Brown. You know? I mean, there are a lot of people who think that. And what I think we have to do is ask ourselves, how do we begin embodying an antidote to that? Articulating, modeling a counter narrative to that. Displaying actions that say, at least with us, as the people of God, if we love our neighbor as ourselves, then I'm going to be asking a different set of questions rather than trying to get into some kind of game of punditry or blame game, etc. I'm going to ask about human beings. So instead of, how about someone asking about, I wonder what Mike Brown's story is. I wonder about the schools he went to and whether they were as well-funded as some people's other schools were. I wonder what his family life was like. I wonder why, if he's caught up in a particular cycle, what does that cycle go back to? How much of that cycle is because of just the way that, you know, there's sin and family problems, etc. And how much of that is tied to the ongoing legacy of what happens when you have a segregated, stratified society where you don't have an equal society, and then even after you pass laws that say things are equal, other things happen to kind of keep things unequal. And then you get things like a welfare system that say that, I don't know who came up with this idea. Hey, here's a great idea with a welfare system. Make sure that you reward people for having children out of wedlock and keeping the man out of the house. Okay, I mean, who thought that that was a good idea? You know, I mean, you know, Daniel Moynihan said, if you guys do it this way, here's what's going to happen. And then, oh, look, Moynihan's a genius. I mean, it makes it seem like the way the welfare was structured, it was designed to make to entrench things for minorities and poor people, rather than to help, you know, people to sort of, you know, get some stability and then, you know, learn to take advantage of opportunities in front of them and flourish. Who thought it was a great idea? And the point isn't that then welfare is the problem, but but the administration of it, obviously, massively problematic. And of course, we are now in a society where it's really not just poor people that are having, you know, single parenting. You know, you've got a lot of middle class single parenting as well. But that, you know, statistics always say the same thing. Single parent households generally do not lead to good outcomes for the children in those households. Because most kids in single parent homes don't have parents who are celebrities. Right? Because, you know, there's celebrity single parents, but what do? They have money. So they can buy what? Help. You know, they can have a whole army of people that raise their kid, that they pay. That's not most single parents. Most single parents, you know, don't make the cover of People magazine or something like that. Anyway, all this to say is that if we're going to take loving God and neighbor seriously, if we're going to have a holistic witness, we can't not attend to these kinds of things and leave it to other people. I'm going to close with this because it's 9:44 and I said that people could ask questions. And they're like, but you said you'd be done 14 minutes ago. Yes, he did. I'll do this in 3 minutes, maybe. Okay. I think one of the things that we have to do to begin taking this dimension of mission seriously and then thinking about strategizing the various ways to participate in some kind of response is we have to first resist averting our gaze from the fact that there is a there that is difficult to look at. I don't know how many of you, if any of you or how many of you saw the movie 12 Years a Slave. But 12 Years a Slave, there are two long takes in the film. Now, a long take is when the camera just sits there. It doesn't move. And if you're in the theater, you're just there. So one long take is when Solomon Northrup gets strung up and the camera's just on him, you know, fighting to stay alive by standing on his tippy toes, you know, with his hand behind his back so that he can breathe. Rather than, because he has to get cut down only by his master. And his master doesn't come home until like the afternoon or whatever. That's one long take. And you can sit there while he's just trying to survive. So that's hard to look at. Harder to look at is when he's at the other plantation and the master makes him beat another slave. And you see the camera, she's here. He's there, the master's there, and the camera just stays there while he beats her. And, you know, lash after lash after lash after lash. And, of course, what you really want to do is, like, get out of the theater. Because you're like, okay, can you, two lashes would have been good enough. Thank you very much. We get it. But, right, until she passes out. And the point is that the camera doesn't let you off the hook. Right, unless you run out of the theater, look down or something. I mean, you can't escape. You can't, like, avert. You actually have to do something to get out of it. Right? So I think part of what Steve McQueen was trying to do there is saying, no, you got to look at this. I mean, it's ugly. It's like what, you know, I mean, I'm not like the biggest James Cullen aficionado by any means, but he wrote a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And Bill Moyers asked him in an interview about it, why write a book called The Cross and the Lynching Tree? And he goes, because lynching is ugly. And we don't like to talk about ugly things or look at ugly things, but we need to look at ugly things. And we have to have the courage to look at ugly, complicated, messy things rather than being tempted to play pretend that those things don't exist. Or by giving ourselves an excuse and saying, well, somebody else will care about that. We need a lot more people to care about it. And we need to be aware and to look at what's there and to understand what's there. But we need to do more than just know what's there and describe it. And part of my reason for saying that is that a lot of times there's a lot of effort that goes into describing what's happened with race in modern America, modern society. But I think part of the reason for all the energy that goes into description is that a lot of people keep averting their gaze or saying, I don't want to see what's there. Or, I'm not convinced that what you say is there is really there. So somebody writes another book saying, maybe if I write this book, they'll recognize that it's really there. So some people need to do the work of description. It's important. But description only tells you that there is a there. A description is not a prescription. All right, the description helps you just to identify something. We need more than identification. We need to then start thinking about what does it mean to embody neighbor love in the face of those things that are one expression of how human dissonance can become very ugly in a complicated, nasty way. All right? And the point is not by saying it's part of a mission. So everybody, you've got to be the Messiah. That's not the point. The point is recognizing that it's part of what we need to attend to. It's not the only thing to attend to, but it's part of what we need to attend to. All right, it's 9:49. I'm going to stop. Stop. See? Okay. There we go. All right? I'm stopping. All right, so who has a question? We have food in 10 minutes. Yes?
I have a question.
Okay.
I think as believers, we have to be careful to think and not think like the world. So, I think about the notion that all 15-year-old black kids are going to shoot other people,
Right.
We get that idea.
Right.
Well, we believe what the culture says. Our local paper here is the Post-Gazette, and every morning, almost every morning, the Post-Gazette reports another shooting of two
yes.
three.
Sure.
And it's in black neighborhoods of
yep.
Pittsburgh or whatever. And yet, I think it's not a black issue. It's a sin issue. We have to realize that. So that when the white kid shoots folks in Sandy Hook or whatever, we as believers can't get trapped in what the world says.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is where the issue is. The issue is much deeper than that.
Right.
Much deeper than that.
Right. Yeah.
And so I have to be careful that as I look at my neighbors, I never get trapped down low. I just can't do that. I cannot think about my neighbors like the world does, but it's so easy to do that.
It is. And I think the thing is, the point is not to say, for example, that there aren't African Americans that are criminals. Of course there are. Right? But people aren't born criminals, most people. I mean, there's occasionally, the person that you're like, wow, this person was like, from age two, people thought, that kid's going to be in jail by the time he's 15, right? I mean, but that's exceptional. Most people, how does somebody wind up being someone that gets in a gang and shoot people, etc.? I mean, how do you get a certain proportion of people winding up being in that kind of circumstance? I mean, there's a lot of factors involved in that. And there's personal responsibility factors involved in that. But it's not, but people are born into contexts. There are things that there's water that they swim in. What about the water that they're swimming in? Well, some people, they are in some toxic water. Okay, so there's toxicity from last night. Okay, remember that? Okay, but guess what? Just because it's toxic, I'm not saying we shouldn't care about it. All right, that's qualification. But the point is that so we have to think about what's systemic, what's personal, how do we attend to the systemic, as well as how do we attend to the personal? Because people often, and it's easier to do this because it's easier to take one side of an issue rather than to try to deal with the tensions between them. People sometimes only want to talk about the structures of society. Other people only want to talk about, well, if they just, why didn't they go to school? Why didn't they whatever? It's like, do you know anything about the school they went to? Do you know anything about their parents? Do you know anything about what their parents tried to do or didn't do? A lot of times I think it's easy for us just to we only think about the moment when something happens, not something happened to get somebody to the point of doing that. I mean, it's the same that we have to. Why is this kid who seemed to be pretty happy last week, shoot his friends in high school? Whoa! Well, that didn't just happen. so we have to think about, there are things around people, right? And we have to weigh, you know, the system, and we have to weigh, you know, personal sinful decisions, activities, etc. And it's hard to do, and it's easy. And but you get easier sound bites if you just talk about personal responsibility or just talk about the system. But you can't just talk about both. I mean, one or the other. You got to talk about both.
You know, growing up here in Beaver Falls, you know, I lived here on the hill. I don't think there were any black children in my elementary school, but then we went downtown to junior high, and it was a new absorption, you know, being surrounded. And I'm just thinking about the mindset. I remember when Beaver Falls played Aliquippa, at Aliquippa, we were never allowed to go to that game. But then I found out that there were these friends of ours that lived in Aliquippa. They weren't allowed to come to Beaver Falls if Beaver Falls played Aliquippa, because their parents were afraid to let them come to Beaver Falls.
Yeah,
and I was shocked.
Right.
So why wouldn't they let them come to Beaver Falls? We know about Aliquippa, but...
Exactly.
Why would they?
Exactly. Exactly.
For me, I found the absorption, working with people and getting to know their circumstances. I worked in a nursing home where most of the nurses, they are black women and men. And it was a very good thing for me, because it helped me to say, well, people instead of the black, that's the
thing. Exactly.
And I think we've got a group here in Beaver Falls called Tiger Paws that reaches out to school students after school. It's an after school program. And I think they're trying to meet the social need. They provide meal, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But they also do Bible study, don't they? Home ec. They do homework, a meal after school, and they do Bible study. So I think they're trying to meet all that.
It's hard.
The social and the personal need. But I think many times as Christians, we are kind of taught not to mess with the social issues because they're not talking about their redemptive personal situations. We need to let
here's the thing about that, right? So here's the kind of thing. People assume, for example, well, of course, I'm sure everybody, when they get up in the morning, you know, they get dressed, they wash up, they eat breakfast, they go to school, etc. I mean, who thinks about the fact kids get up, maybe they eat breakfast, maybe they don't. Not because, wow, that kid's just, you know, got just a dynamo, they're so fast, etc. No, because... there's either nothing to eat, or their circumstances, one where, you know, the parent might be there, might not be there. And the parent might be there, might not be there because they're working two or three jobs, or because they're strung out. I mean, we don't know. But there are all kinds of things that are taken for granted about just what, quote-unquote, a person's normal day is. And all of those things are factors in things like academic success. Why don't they behave? Well, you know, well, they're hungry. They don't know where their parents are. All those kinds of things, you know, it's not just, you know, Johnny or Jill or whoever just sitting there, just do your work. Well, okay, is the work the only thing that's on this kid's mind right now? So that there are complications that aren't present to us. If we don't know about those, you know, a lot of people think, well, yeah, you know, they just need to work harder. Just need to work harder, really. Well, that's interesting. Well, harder at which thing? And what are you expecting a 12-year-old to do that, now I'm going with another stereotype, that some suburban 12-year-old doesn't even think about? And this kid, for them, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff they have to do. It's like survival mode. Over here, it's like, well, you know, other people take care of that. Like my parents, you know, or whatever. Or my relatives, or whatever. So if we're not trying to understand what's going on, it's easy to just revert to you know, nice sound bites. Well, you know, if they would just. Well, okay, they who? Right. Depersonalization is very easy. I mean, and depersonalization, by the way, I mean, you see how it happens on both sides. Don't send those kids to Beaver Falls. Why? Well, they can get lynched. I mean, people are like, nobody's going to get lynched. You know, but people are like, I'm not sending my kid over there. Right? So it's like different outrage.
Question about urban ministry. Urban medicine is stigmatized.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
How is that effective when maybe it could be perceived and maybe it's even displayed as a superior for people coming into
A sort of a paternalism type thing?
Yeah. Is that detrimental?
I think it's tricky, right? Because it's like the question about short-term missions right now. A lot of people are talking about short-term missions. Well, short-term missions, what's that? That is, you know, sort of like mission as vacation, right? Well, you know, for some people, it's mission as vacation. For some people, I mean, it's like, well, it's good for people to be exposed, to do certain things. But for other people, it's missional tourism, right? So to me, it depends upon what people are doing. So to me, the question isn't whether people should be there, but how are people thinking about what they're doing? How are they thinking about their own need to learn as well as their own desire to serve? How are they thinking about what they have to offer, but also how they want to partner with people rather than just deliver things to people? But I mean, you've got to get into it in order to, I think, to do that kind of discernment. And I think that there are a lot of people, because people say, well, they're just so paternalistic and they're telling us this and this and this and this. Part of me wants to say, well, if someone has something you don't have and you could actually benefit from it, then both of you got to figure out what's the best way for you to get the benefit. And to me, an improper response to a paternalistic approach is to say, just leave us alone. Because just leave us alone maybe is leaving us behind. So it's how do you negotiate the way that you engage? But I think part of it is if people know that you were there. And it's not like that somehow you think you're getting a notch on your belt because you're doing this. I mean, you actually care about them, and you want to get to know people, and you want to hear their stories. You want to listen. You want to learn as well as not just to deliver things, but to help equip people so that they are doing things.
Hopefully, the gospel will infuse them.
Well, you would hope, but you know, we have big problems with that. It's the same case if quote unquote the mythical average United States citizen goes to most places in the world, right? The fact that you come from the United States sometimes, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing, right? So how are you helpful without saying, well, of course, you know, the Americans have come. Right. Because why? Because we're the heroes of, you know, the world. That's why. Well, that's really not the way we want to think about it. So we don't want people to think that way. Because there are people who want to, like, help us, please. Okay. But what's the best way for us to work together here? Some of it requires, hey, I've got to give you information, skills, tools, etc. But the goal isn't for me to just act like I'm superior to you. I do recognize I have an opportunity to serve you. And if I'm serving you, you know, how am I serving you rather than just saying, oh, poor person, you know, here you go. So I think this is part of the cultivation of what we have to do with each other as the people of God, so that we're oriented to serve. So, okay, I think it's probably 10 o'clock.
Why don't you pray for us before we go down?
Okay, all right. Let me just... we'll see. I will. Okay, because when I open it back up, it's like it says the time that it was when I closed it. So, and then eventually... All right, let's pray. Thanks, God, for your word. Thank you for the privilege of the fact that there's a mission for us. Lord, help us to develop discernment about what it means to understand more and more what your mission for us is, and for us to consider myriad ways, many ways, to be faithful in our response to it. Lord, it's so easy to just be overwhelmed by the great problems and challenges that there are in the world. Race is not just one of them. Poverty is not just one of them. There's all kinds of problems in all kinds of places. Lord, give us wisdom so that we may be like lights in this dark world. Lights by showing how we are becoming more and more aware of the challenges that there are, and more aware of ways that you enable us to serve you and bring the gospel, not just in terms of what we communicate, but also what we do with our hands with others in your world. Lord, we thank you for the food that we will share. We pray that you will use it to nourish us and bless us. We pray this in the name of Christ. Amen.